Can you take your Bible and turn with me to the book of Matthew's Gospel, chapter 24. Matthew's Gospel, chapter 24. Now, on Monday night, we were thinking about what we call the spirit of fear. And it's safe to say that God does not want his people to be living crushed by a spirit of fear. Not in regards to the transgressions of the past or of the troubles of the day. And maybe when we were dealing with it, and you picked up that we were thinking about the past and the present, and you might have been wondering to yourself, well, what about the future? Because, of course, there is a past, and there is today, but there is tomorrow. And what about that spirit of fear in regards to tomorrow? Well, let's take a wee look here at Matthew's Gospel, chapter 24. And look at verse 4. And Jesus answered and said unto them, take heed that no man deceive you. Now you think, the truth be told, that Christians do tend to be a wee bit simplistic and a wee bit naive, and sometimes we're ready there to be taken to the cleaners. We sort of believe people. And especially any voice that is out there that's a spiritual voice, a religious voice, we are sort of leaning that direction. We're almost saying, here I am, if you want to deceive me, I'm ready there to be deceived. I think it's good and healthy for every Christian to have a good dose of healthy skepticism. That out there are voices, and they would like to try to deceive us and misguide us, mislead us, and lead us into false beliefs and false doctrines, and so we have to be very, very careful not to be deceived. And especially in particular areas of thinking. Look what he goes on to say. Verse 5. For many shall come in my name, saying, I am Christ, and shall deceive many. So there are voices out there that will be loud, and they'll declare themselves to be voices of God, and they'll say, come and follow me, and you may be persuaded thus, and be thus deceived, and follow them, and end up in serious trouble, far away from the truth, and far away from God. Be not deceived. Be skeptical, and be persuaded only by the teaching of the Word of God. No matter how wonderful the personality is, no matter how smart he happens to be, no matter how well versed in the Bible he happens to be, you make sure that it's the Bible that speaks and not the voice of a man. Let the Word of God be the final authority. Now take a look at verse 6, because those voices can be allied to events that may make you think that voice is the voice of God, because this is the voice that comes out of these big events that are happening, and I must listen to that voice and follow that voice because it may be the voice of God. Look at verse 6. And ye shall hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that ye be not troubled. For all these things must come to pass, but the end is not yet. For nation shall rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom, and there shall be famines, and pestilences, and earthquakes, in all sorts of places. So what's he saying? He's saying, there may be voices heard that will say, I am the Christ, I'm the voice of God, come and follow me. And those voices will be more dangerous when they're there, when something bad happens globally around the world. I remember in 1984, the planets were in alignment. And there were wee religious tracks going around saying that the moment when these planets align, there's going to be tremendous tidal waves and tsunamis, and the world, as it were, will come to an end, and the Lord's going to come. But of course, it came and it went, and we didn't know the difference. Of course, when communism came, and the Bolsheviks took over Russia, and there you had those communist leaders, and there was Stalin, and many Christians believe there's Stalin, he's the Antichrist, it's the end of the world. Well, Stalin came and Stalin went and Stalin was buried, but you know, things have just continued. And of course then when Adolf Hitler began marching and Louis Moustache, and he slaughtered the Jews, and again many a Christian believed that wee man with Louis Moustache and his wicked and his depraved spirit, that's the man, that's the Antichrist, the end is here, Jesus, he's on his way. Well, Hitler came and Hitler went. But Jesus hasn't come yet. Of course, the turn of the millennium, and many a Christian had an expectation that whenever the end of the old century came and the last millennium came and we became a new century, a new millennium, the third millennium, and many a Christian thought, this is it now. Listen for the sound of the trumpet. Look to the skies. The clouds are going to part. Pick your bags. We're heading to the clouds. Jesus is on his way. Well, the millennium came and it went, and here we still are. Do you know something? We should just leave the second coming to the Lord. Yes, he's coming someday. And yes, we should have a sense of the times. But at the end of the day, we are Christians living in this world, and we have a purpose in our lives, but we shouldn't be obsessed with the Lord's return, and be stargazing and speculating, and then being disappointed when he doesn't come, when we think he should have came, and he didn't come, and were we but disillusioned? No. You see, he's saying here that all these things happen. I have an old dictionary, and there's a section at the end of it, and it's more than just a dictionary. It is a history of the human race. And it's all year by year by year. And of course, it's a history. That's all the stuff here that's found in Matthew's Gospel chapter 24. It's all about tsunamis and floods and earthquakes and pestilences and tribal warfare and nation raising against nation and the community against community. And that's the history of the human race. That's the way it is today. What do you think our tomorrow's going to be? Do you think we've seen our last earthquake? You think we've seen our last tsunami? You think that once they get the Middle East all sorted out and they get the nail boards all nailed down and it's all peaceful now, you don't think that somewhere else in the world it's all going to kick off and there's going to be wars and rumors of wars? I'm sorry, that's our future. It's the past, it's the present day, it's the future. That's just the way it is. That's the norm, and that's the backdrop of the Christian church. That's just the way it is. Get used to it. And that's what he's saying to the disciples. He says, just because you see a big tsunami, don't look to the skies and think that Jesus is coming again, or just because there's a massive war taking place in some part of the world, that's the sign Jesus, he's on his way. Oh no, he says, that's where it's always going to be. That's always going to backdrop. That's the wallpaper of the church age. It's just a backdrop. Now, take a wee look at that verse again, because I want you to notice something. Chapter 24 there, verse 6, where it says, and ye shall hear of wars and rumors of wars. And of course, he then he talks about nation rising against nation, and there's the earthquakes and the famines and pestilences. But in verse 6 he says, about us he says, see that ye be not troubled. You see what's going on in the Middle East at the moment? I tell you, an awful lot of people are troubled by it. You see this word trouble here, it means to be frightened. And you're afraid of going to bus. You're afraid of going to boat. who are afraid of fire, afraid of you to train. And every time you see somebody that's a Muslim and you wonder, is that guy, is there a bomb in it? And everybody's hearts are filling with fear. Why? Because they're scared of the Muslim world. Because there's so much fear coming from it. And people are scared. Jesus says to the disciples, in this world of earthquakes and tsunamis, a nation raising against nation, and all this pestilence and all this insecurity, in the midst of all of that, while others are terrified and fearful, he says, I don't want you to be terrified. See, these are the terrors of tomorrow. So why should you not be frightened? Why can Jesus say that to his children, who are also human beings living in this real world with all that as a backdrop? Why shouldn't we be frightened? Aren't we human after all? Well, the Lord Jesus Christ comes and he says, listen, I understand your humanity, but there's some truths you need to get a hold of that means you're not going to be as frightened as others are. You actually should have a decent dollop of peace reigning in your heart. Now, what are these glorious truths? Will you come with me to the book of Daniel? We'll come to Daniel in a moment. But first of all, the book of Proverbs, chapter 21. Proverbs, chapter 21. And take a look at verse 1. Now, King Solomon is the writer of the book of Proverbs, man of wisdom. And of course, he is also the king of Israel. And he says here in verse 1, he says, the king's heart. That's the place of all the planning and all the motivations and all the dreams and all the goals and all the intellect and all the scheming and all the determination and purpose and drive. It's all in the king's heart. But then it says this, the king's heart, where is it? It's in the hand of the Lord. As Solomon said, Lord, I haven't deceived myself to think that I am the king of Israel because I'm a smart man, or because I'm good looking, or because I'm muscular, or because of my intellect, or anything else. He said, I'm a king because God, you have purposed it so. It's your will. I could be as thick as champ, as we say, and the Lord will have a purpose for my life. You could be without any talent, any gift, any ability, but God has a purpose for your life. And here's a king and he says, I am the king of Israel, and I am the king of Israel. Why? Because being king of Israel fits in with the purpose of God for the nation of Israel. I'm just a piece on the chessboard that God picks up, moves around. I'm in the hand of God. I like this wee bit that comes next, because this takes me to Portrush. It says here, as the rivers of water, he turns it whithersoever he will. Now that takes me to Portrush, as I'm saying. Because whenever we were small, and my mum and my dad grew up in Coleraine, so that was his part of the world, so we always took us off to Portrush for a day at the beach. And of course, the big enterprise of the day was to build yourself big sand castles, and sometimes a reservoir filled with water. And the reservoir was nothing more than just a big wall of sand. And then you get your bucket, head into the sea, bring the sea back to the reservoir, you fill it up, and there it is, a reservoir of water. Then you take your heel, or maybe a stick, the wee speed you have with your bucket, and you would scoop a riverbed from the wall of the dam right across the beach. I was going to create a river. And it was my choice as to where I wanted the river to flow. I could scoop the track this direction, swing around this, back that way again, back this way again, around the other way, and then I burst the dam, out comes the water. The water is not alone unto itself. The water doesn't say, there's the sea from whence I came, I'm heading back to the sea. Oh no, it's not. It's going where I have scooped the track, the riverbed, in the sand. I have determined its path. See, that's the insight, that's the wisdom of the king of Israel, Solomon. He says, God, I might sit here thinking I'm some big cheese and I control things and I determine things and purpose things, but I recognize, God, you are the sovereign God, and Israel as a nation will be and do as you determine it, and you'll find kings to be kings as you will it, and you'll dispense with them as you will it. You're the sovereign God. The book of Daniel. This time, it's Daniel chapter 2. Now, poor Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, it didn't seem to be, he was a great sleeper. He'd waken up with the sweats and tremors, and they had an horrendous nightmare. In this particular chapter, he had one of those awful nightmares. He had a dream, and the dream was this big, massive the beast, this big image. It was made out of certain metals. The head was gold, and we'll take a look at verse 31. Because Nebuchadnezzar goes to Daniel, and he says, Daniel, you're a man that understands all these things, and you're in touch with your God. Can you tell me my dream and tell me what the lesson is, what the significance is, what it's all about? And here's what Daniel says. Thou, O king, says, thou sawest and beheld a great image. And this image, whose brightness was excellent, stood before thee, and the form thereof was great. This image's head was of fine gold, his breast and his arms were of silver, and his belly and his thighs was of brass, and his legs of iron, and his feet part of iron and part of clay. Thou sawest until a stone was cut out without hands, which smote the image upon its feet, and that were of iron and clay, and break it in pieces. He says, that's your dream. He says, you're right. That's exactly what I dreamt. That image. Different metals. And a stone comes out of heaven, smites the image in the feet, and the whole thing is shattered to pieces. Now, he says, Daniel, what's the dream all about? And of course, to cut the long story short, this beast represents Gentile domination of human history. The head is the Babylonian Empire. The chest, the empire of the Medes and the Persians. And in the stomach, that's the Alexander the Great. And in the legs, that's the Roman Empire. That's Gentile domination of human history. And a stone comes out of the heavens and spices this Gentile beast and brings it down. You see, we're still in the days of the Gentiles. It's the Gentiles that dominate human history. And those kingdoms down there, glorious kingdoms, mighty kingdoms, but they came and they went as God had so determined it. Now, of course, it took Daniel a wee bit of courage to tell this to King Nebuchadnezzar. He says in verse 36, this is the dream, and we will give thee the interpretation thereof before the king. He says, thou, O king, are a king of kings, for the God of heaven has given thee a kingdom and power and strength and glory. So he says, Nebuchadnezzar, I've got a good news for you. You are the head of the first kingdom. But the stone is going to bring the whole thing down. You may think your kingdom is glorious and mighty and powerful, and that you're a big frog sitting in this great big pond in the middle of the Middle East there, but God's going to destroy it all in due time. Go to chapter 2, because chapter 2 is another dream. Look at verse 11. Chapter 4 of Daniel and verse 11. And this time it's not so much the image as a whole, but we're now looking at the head, only this time it's in the form of another dream. It's the Babylonian Empire. It's Nebuchadnezzar in particular. He says, the tree grew and was strong, and the height thereof reached unto the heaven, and the sight thereof to the ends of the earth. So this dream that Nebuchadnezzar had, it was a mighty tree. It was the Babylonian Empire. It was glorious. It was mighty. The branches reached to the ends of the earth of that particular day. says in verse 12, the leaves thereof were fair, and the fruit thereof was much, and it was meat for all. This was economically a prosperous kingdom. Oh, no run on the banks there, no bankrupt currencies, no market collapses, no. This was a strong economic kingdom that fed, as it were, all the other kingdoms of the earth. It was a mighty, glorious financial kingdom. Says the beast of the field had shadow under it, and the fowls of the heaven dwelt in its bowels thereof, and all flesh was fed of it. And so on. Look at verse 14 now. Verse 13 says, I saw in my vision on my head upon the bed, and behold, a watcher, a holy one, came down from heaven. And he cried aloud and said thus, hew down the tree, and cut off its branches, shake off its leaves, and scatter its fruit. You see, this is God saying, hey, get yourself a hatchet. Wield it. And cut this big man-made kingdom down. It's had its time in the sun. It is now time for it to leave the stage. It is now time for it to become a has-been. Nothing more than a chapter in history. It is time for it to go. It has to leave the stage. Cut it down and destroy it. It was destroyed. You see, what are we learning? This is the sovereignty of God. God raises it up. God will remove it. Now, there's a wee verse that's repeated about 4 or 5 times in those 2 or 3 chapters. Take a look at verse 17. He says, this matter is by the decree of the watchers, and the demand by the word of the holy ones, and I get this wee bit here, for the intention that the living may know that the Most High ruleth in the kingdoms of men, and he giveth him soever he will, and he setteth over it even the basest of men. Well, it's a marvelous thing to look back in history. And you see leaders there that were somewhat decent. Churchill, Abraham Lincoln, Washington, Gandhi. You know, decent men who had a sense of right and wrong and better social justice and fairness and democracy and freedom and liberty. Oh, but when you look back there, I see the Adolf Hitlers. Oh, he's there as well. I see the Stalins. Oh, they're all there as well. You see, it's not just godly men that raises up. Sometimes for the purposes of God, God will raise up even the basest of men, evil and depraved men. And God is still sovereign. And God sets the boundaries to their activity and to the behavior, and they not transgress those boundaries because God is the sovereign God. Now, did you get the wee bit that says, the Most High ruleth in the kingdoms of men? You see, that word ruleth, it actually means to dominate. To dominate. So let us say that this is not a Bible study as it is. Let's say it's like a business meeting. And the pastor here, as he's taking notes, as the scribe, the secretary, who says what and what is tabled, what motions are passed, what motions are carried, and so on. And he has a note at the end of the page that my cousin Tommy down there, Tommy McGrath, dominated the meeting. Time passes, years pass by, we're all dead and gone, but some other generation who are here, and someday some guy finds a wee ledger and he looks the historical one, this particular date, and everything written there by the pastor about this particular meeting, and he sees this name, Tommy McGrath. And this man called McGrath, he dominated that meeting that day. What impression would they get of Tom's role in the meeting? But he sat in the back and said nothing. That maybe he did say something, but with such a low voice that nobody could decipher what he said. Or would they get the impression, Tommy, he set the agenda? His voice was heard loud and clear. And all reaction out of the meeting was, in accordance with his will, It was his meeting, his will. He dominated the meeting. So that's what this is saying here. Our God, he ruleth in the kingdoms of man. So yes, there's bad things happening out there. And you can understand how politicians and MPs and prime ministers and presidents are all, you know, the hands are shaking and they're trying to figure out what's going on. And I read in the paper that some of these guys sent this week. They were at one of the nuclear power plants taking photographs, and that was probably one of the targets they're going to target it. That's scary business. But they got them. You know, scary. But listen, our God controls it all. And nothing's going to happen that transgresses the limits and the boundaries of God's sovereign will. And we are all in the hand of God. His sovereign will. Find rest there. Find comfort there. Find a security there. He has the whole world in his hand, and he's got us as well, round about us, with the everlasting arms. But that's not just the only thing. The sovereignty of God, that brings that comfort and reassurance that sort of minimizes those terrors of the future. Can you turn to a wee verse we looked at? Psalm 23. Psalm 23. And while you hook that down, I want to read you a wee verse that's found in 2 Timothy. 2 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 1. This is what it says. It says, this know also. So some things as Christians, you ought to have a good list of things you ought to know. It says, get this in your list. Make sure you memorize it. So if you're not taken by surprise, you're expecting it. What is it? Know this. The perilous times shall come. Dangerous times. Yeah. Times that, from a human point of view, would terrify you. It's persecution. And the word times is a lovely word. It actually means seasons. Seasons. I like seasons. Well, that's one thing Northern Ireland has. It's got four seasons. Sometimes it all comes in one day. But they're there. You know when you're in the spring, and you know when it's the summer, and you know when it's the fall, and you sure know that it is the winter time. Cold and damp and bleak, and you shiver. And sometimes it seems it's very, very long, that it's never going to end. But the seasons are there. But here's a good thing. Even when it's a cold, freezing, damp old winter, you know, hang in there, because the seasons change, and soon the winter will pass. You'll see the spring, the wee buds, and then the summer sea and the sun shines. The seasons come and the seasons go. Look at Psalm 23. We looked at it the other night. It says, the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He makes me to lie down in green pastures, and he leads me beside the still waters. You see, he leads us sometimes, he brings the spring and the summer in. The spring and the summer of green pastures and still waters, when you just feel the sun shining in your cheeks, and you say, isn't life wonderful? Isn't life grand? It's great to be alive. The Lord's blessed us so much, our family, our business, the job, the finances, all is well. It couldn't be any better. But listen, the seasons change. Sometimes those good times move on, and they're replaced with those bad times, when a chill comes in, and the clouds come in, and the darkness comes in, and you sometimes wonder, where is God in the winter like this? Where are you, God? Because look at verse 6, here's the winter, you see. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death. And then he says, I will fear no evil. Why? For thou art with me, thy rod and thy staff, they comfort me. You see, what this psalm is all about is simply this. It's not just the sovereignty of God that brings assurance and peace to our hearts. It is also the knowledge of his providential care for his people. He's not just with you. He cares for you.
I went to Bible school in Canada in 1975 to 1979. And I flew off there and I arrived there, and this was a strange land. And I was glad to get any communication from home, and I got this wee letter from a dear friend called Jimmy Evans, and some of you might know Jimmy. And Jimmy is a wonderful saint of God, a blessing to my life. He's like a spiritual father to me in my young days as a young Christian. And Jimmy sent me a wee letter to tell me what's happening back in Macrafelt and wish me well. And he was kind enough to send me a wee gift. And it was a gift of £5 in the form of a £5 British postal order. I remember getting it and be grateful for it, but I just sort of giggled myself and think, Jimmy, you know as much about this world as I do. If it had been $5 Canadian, I could have cashed it in and spent it. If it had been £5 British, I could have changed the dollars and spent it. But what in the world am I going to do with a £5 British postal order in Saskatchewan, Canada? I'll put it in the wallet, and 3 or 4 years' time when I get back to Macrafelt, then I'll buy some sweeties with it back then, and I'll sort of, to the glory of Jimmy, I'll maybe buy Jimmy a lollipop with it as well, in appreciation. So I just stuck it away in my wee wallet, forgot all about it. Of course, the thing came when I'd done all the studies, I'd become a theologian, you see, and was ready to come back to Northern Ireland and put yours all straight and tell you about God's truth, and you know that, you know, my young Bible students feel at times we're like theologians overnight. And so I came back with two big heavy suitcases, and I go up to the desk in a place called Saskatoon to take my first flight to Toronto, and then at Toronto I was heading off to Ireland, I got to this, and I put the two big suitcases on what turned out to be weigh scales. The girl says, oh, this is going to cost you a lot. I mean, what do you mean cost? This is my airline ticket. Does this not just go with me? Oh, she says, no. If you read the print of your ticket and stuff, you discover you're only allowed so much weight. Oh. And I says, but this is all the Canadian dollars I've left and a wee bit of British money to get me home to my base whenever I get there. She says, well, that's not enough to get you all the way to Ireland. She says, the best I can do for you is to treat the trip to Toronto as an internal flight. And I'll take what cash you have there in Canadian money, but when you get to Toronto, you have to reclaim your luggage and then put it back through the system for Ireland and take your chances with the desk in Toronto. I says, well, maybe the Lord might come and it'll not matter. So I was sitting on board the aeroplane flying off, and I got into Toronto and I reclaimed the luggage, and I had no Canadian money left for the rest of the journey. And I was dragging these two big suitcases with all the books and the tools and dragging it down the big terminal and all these desks, and I'm looking for an Air Canada desk where the guy behind the counter was someone that looked an old softie. And I saw this wee man sitting there like he was half asleep, no customers as it were. Grey hair, a wee grey moustache, looked like an old man that should have been retired years ago. I thought, that man will do me. He may not notice the weight of the luggage. So I dragged the suitcases up and he invited me to put the luggage onto the weigh scales. And I knew that's bad news. So I did what I was told and I put it on the weigh scales, and he looks at me and he says, young fella, wherever you're going, this is going to cost you an awful lot. You're way beyond your limit. I said, sir, I haven't a Canadian cent. It's all gone. He says, where are you going? I says, I'm going to Ireland. Oh, he says, Ireland. Oh, he says, which part of Ireland? I says, the north. Sort of think of that being like Belfast sort of thing. Oh, he says, I have some wonderful memories of Northern Ireland. He says, I was stationed there during the war. And he says, I stayed at a wee place there, and he scratched his head trying to think of it. And a wee place called The Loop. You wouldn't hear tell of it. It's just a wee small place. I says, The Loop? You mean outside a bigger town called Macrafelt? Oh, Macrofelt, he says, that's the name of the big town nearby. He says, and there's a shop here and there's a pub down there. And he says, are they still there? And of course, I handed him my passport and he looks at it and I say, take a look at my name and address. Samuel George Finley, that's me. My address, 5 Mullaboy Crescent, Macrofelt, County Londonderry. That's my hometown. We got into a conversation for 30 minutes, but there's wonderful times in Macrofelt and Lulip. And I said to him, well, can you help me get back to Macrofelt? And he says, ah, young fella, the flight's only half full. It'll be neither here nor there. He says, away you go and God bless you and have a good time back in Macrofelt. Wasn't I lucky? I'm a very lucky fella, you know. Absolutely. I could have chosen another desk. And my clothes and my books might still be in Canada. I chose the right guy. I was so lucky. I chose the right guy that was stationed in the loop during the war. And he was kind-hearted, let me through. I was a really lucky fella that day. So I was sitting out here in Ireland. Now, you're smart enough in Ballymena. You'd arrive at Aldergrove, wouldn't you? You'd fly in there. Well, I don't know what possessed me to arrange it. I flew into Shannon Airport in the south of Ireland. Kind of crazy when you look back on it, but that's my worth. And I arrived away in the south of Ireland, Shannon Airport, and there was a wee journey by bus from the airport to a town where I get the train for Belfast. And that sort of cleaned me out of a wee bit of the British money. Remember, this was before the euro and before the pound. When the currency north and south were the same, British currency for both parts of Ireland, 1979. So I got to the town where the train station was, and I got up to the wee kiosk. I put all the money I had on the counter, and I said to the lady, can you get me or tell me how far would that money there take me to Belfast? She says, I'm sorry, what's there? That'll only take you 2 stops south of Dublin. I says, well, again, I was thinking maybe the Lord may come, may not matter. But at least I'm heading for Dublin, at least 2 stops south of Dublin. So I got on board, got the suitcase rolled out, headed off. And of course, I'd flown transatlantic. My body clock was all haywire. I was so jet-lagged, I was exhausted. I fell asleep. I think I was sleeping next door to a coma. I was in such a deep sleep. I wakened up because a man was waking me. I've been shaken. I heard his voice saying, young fellow, waking up. Waking up. We're coming into O'Connell train station in Dublin. I need to see your ticket. And I waken up. Now, you know that feeling where you still feel like you're in an aeroplane. You don't know where you are. And you're hooking about your pocket for the ticket. And I hand this wee man the ticket. And he looks at it. And of course he sees the suitcases. And he says, ah, young fellow, where'd you come from? I said, I've just flown transatlantic all the way from Canada. He says, no wonder you fell into a deep sleep. I have bad news for you. You've missed your stop. And he's all apologetic. He says, the best I can do for you is, we're coming into the O'Connell train station. You find a wee set of steps. You go down those steps. And you turn right. And you walk 50 yards there. And there's a bus stop. And they'll take you back to where you should have got off. I was really grateful for all the information. I didn't really need it now. And I said, thank you very much, sir. I'll sort myself out. I now unwittingly and in good conscience found myself in Dublin. With not a penny in my pocket to get to Belfast. So what do? Hope through your pockets in case maybe you missed a few dollars or a few pounds or something and all, just the wallet, an empty wallet, not even a moth. And then I noticed this wee folded up white thing. What in the world is that? Oh, Jimmy Evans, wee £5 British postal order. Oh, that suggested a little living hope. This might be worth something. 4 o'clock in the afternoon, I asked somebody if there's a post office nearby. It might be worth a fiver. It's worth a try. And there's a wee post office nearby. I dragged the suitcases down there, wee lady behind the desk. I didn't want to make any eye contact. I just slipped under the counter and I heard that wonderful sound of the sound of something being stamped. And I got a fiver. And I thought, get out of there quick in case she catches on and realises what's going on here. And she might want the money back. Get out quick. And I raced out and I've gone back to the Connaught train station. And I went up to their kiosk to get, you know, I put the fiver down there and I said to the man, how far does that take me to Belfast? Oh, he says, sir, that takes you all the way because the ticket for Belfast is £5 exactly. That's it on the button. Wasn't I lucky that Jimmy Evans sent me a gift? Not in cash terms, either in dollars or in pounds, that I could cash it in and spend it all in a form that I couldn't use it until I needed it. And it was exactly the right amount. Some of these days I'm going to do the lottery because I've got a feeling I'm going to win it. If ever you read the headlines in Belfast Telegraph, preacher wins £10 million the lottery, it's going to be me. But listen, I don't respond to begging letters. I'm happy for you, lucky. It seems. And I sat on the train on the way home thinking, you know, this isn't luck. It's not even coincidence. This is something else. This is what this is all about. The providential care of God for his people. My mum died in 1979. And I got the call that morning at about 6 o'clock from my brother-in-law, Jim Beattie. And Jim says, you'll get here quickly. Your mum's going to die very, very soon. Get here as quick as you can. By the time I got myself dressed and put together, the phone rang again. And Jim says, she's gone. So I headed off feeling very low. Like looking down from the edge and the safety net's completely all gone now. My dad was already gone. My mum's now gone. That safety net's now completely gone altogether. That feeling of loss and loneliness. And I headed off and it was dark and I was going through Tombridge. And just outside the police station, I saw the wee light, the wee red light. And I thought, that seems strange. A police road check. It's been years since I've seen that, come across that. The peace process is well bedded in 1992, and there's no bombs going off, there's no security danger, and there's no police road checks and so on. And yet here's one. And I drove up along the policeman, and I had the window already wound down, and just as I came alongside, I reached for the wee glove compartment to get my license to identify who I was, and the voice of the policeman says, "Ah, you'll not need that, I know who you are." And he says, "Where in the world are you going this time in the morning?" And I look around and look at him, and then he says, "You don't recognise me, do you?" And I says, "I don't." And then he took the hat off, and there I reckon you know him. David Mitchell from Bally Baptist Church. David Mitchell. And it was him, and I said, "David didn't recognise you with the hat on, the uniform, you know." Then he says, "I'm sorry to hear," when I told where I was going, that my mum had just passed away. And of course, he offered his condolences, and he reminded me that around about are those everlasting arms and the promise of God, he'll never leave us or forsake us. And I headed off thinking to myself, you know, I'm lucky again that, you know, there I am, heading off that time of the morning, and what's the chance of a roadblock and a policeman there, a Christian policeman, and a Christian policeman that I know. What's the chance of that just being coincidental or just good luck? I thought, no. That's more. That's God and his providential care. The same God that realized how I was trying to get home to Macrofelt from Canada, and he realised the way, and he thought, this guy's never going to get home, so a couple of angels, and he can now chaperone this guy, and first of all, put it in the heart of Jimmy Evans to send him a gift that he's going to need it. And, you know, it's those angels again. Providential care of God. Whenever I was at the Bible school, a fellow there called Don Weeb, and Don had a wee aeroplane. Canadian. And Don, I knew Don well, and he says, "You'll get on beside me there. I'll give you a wee spin on the aeroplane and off we go." And and the bumping along this old field, and whoo, up onto the air we go. And then he says, you set the goggles on the wee desk, the wee dashboard. And he says, you see those goggles, would you like me to make them just rise off the desk like that, the dashboard like that? And I said something very stupid. I said, yes. And he caused them to rise just like that. Of course, what he did was very simple. He cut the engine of the aeroplane, and it just sort of fell out of the sky like a stone. And it wasn't just the goggles rising off the dashboard. I was rising off the seat I was sitting in, and my breakfast was rising off the floor, the stomach ready for the exit. And then, of course, it gets the engine going, it gets it back in the equilibrium, and he says, what do you think of that? And I'm sitting there with almost heart attack, and I says, ah, Don, please, no more tricks. Please just get me back home in one piece. Get me on dry land. Now, how do you turn an aeroplane? You don't turn it like you turn a motor car. You turn it like that, and the four wheels you see on the ground. No, you bank an aeroplane. It goes from that to this. And I'm lying there in this wee thing that looks very human. Like jumbo jets look like they come out of a factory made by angels in heaven. But this thing, you see every rivet, and you realize human beings made like this. I hope they're paying attention when they put the lock on that door. And I'm lying there, and every instinct says, you're going to flip this thing over. You're going to fall out. You're going to die. So do something. Help this guy to keep it from flipping over. So what do? You lean the other direction. And I'm leaning the other way, my head in his lap. And he grabs me and he throws me back and he says, Yule, what in the world are you doing? And I says, Don, you're terrified. I just feel I'm going to fall out and this thing's going to flip over and we're going to crash and be killed. I'm just trying to help you to keep it from flipping over. He says, will you lie back there and recognize I'm an expert pilot. I've flown this thing for years. I know how to fly it. I'm an expert. Just lie back there and trust me. That was it. That's all I had to learn to do. Easy says, Mindy, and he got me down. He never got me back up again. But I learned that lesson. He was trained. He was an expert. He'd flown this thing more often than I had ever driven a car. He knows all about turbulence. He knows all about banking. He knows all about landing. Trust him. See, your God's on the throne. And he cares for you. And as you make your way through tomorrow and the future, he knows all that lies ahead. And he just wants you to put your hand in his hand and trust him all the way.